In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Hello once again. And welcome to another episode of Strange Planet. And if you'd like to get deeper into Strange Planet, you can consider becoming a premium subscriber. And it's real easy to do. Just click on the link in the episode notes, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. There are 3 monthly premium packages to choose from. Choose the one that's right for you. You gain access to commercial-free listening, bonus episodes, special bonus episodes produced just for premium subscribers. You also get a subscription to my monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. On this episode, we are going to explore the profound connections between emotions and their physical manifestations in illness. In his brand new book, The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress, Jerry Cantor explains how to use prominent emotional and physical symptoms to determine the core existential stress underlying one's chronic condition. He also introduces 5 seminal existential questions correlating with both the 5 miasms of homeopathy and the 5 phases of traditional Chinese medicine. And he presents homeopathic remedies connected to specific existential quandaries and explains their indications through detailed examples from his practice. Jerry Cantor is a faculty member of the Ontario College of Homeopathic Medicine and owner of Vital Force Healthcare LLC, a Boston area homeopathy and acupuncture practice, the first acupuncturist to receive an academic appointment at Harvard Medical School's Department of Anesthesiology. Jerry is the author of The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Sane Asylums, Interpreting Chronic Illness, The Toxic Relationship Cure, and Autism Reversal Toolbox. And he joins us, I believe, from his home in Dedham, Massachusetts. Jerry, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine, Richard. Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
Last time we spoke, I believe you had just published Sane Asylums.
Yes,
so it's right. Good to have you back. What do you mean by existential stress? What do you mean by, or what is meant by existentialism?
Yeah, it's kind of an egghead term from the beatnik era that's regaining currency. Climate change is an existential stress. War in the Middle East is an existential stress. Basically, the way it's being used in the media is, oh, my God, we're all going to die. But it means more than that. Very, very basically, it goes to the question of human existence. What's the point of life? And when things are going well and everybody's kind of a happy camper, we don't ask that question so often. We tend to have things to do, more pressing issues than our everyday, than thinking about our lives. But actually, what I found is when in analyzing chronic illness, when someone has a condition that's just persistent, always there, when you analyze it homeopathically, with a little help from Chinese medicine, you can detect an existential quandary under there that is inflamed, that has a big charge, and that is actually fueling your susceptibility to illness and the actuality of it.
Is this something new? I mean, I'm thinking like 100 years ago, people were so preoccupied with making sure their crops didn't fail. I suppose that could be an existential stress that would keep you up at night. But for the most part, we were so busy just trying to survive. We didn't have time to think of a lot of the issues that are, going on in the world right now. Is it new or has it always been around?
Actually, the one you just mentioned is one of my core questions, which I've articulated as, is my existence on Earth sustainable? Mm. And people can have that, of course, when they really are under starvation situations or if they're in a drought. But actually, it's one of the bigger existential questions if you measure it by the remedies that are attached to the conditions that question fuels. Mostly metabolic illnesses, gastrointestinal things. In homeopathy land, it would be reframed as the soric miasm, P-S-O-R-I-C, sora. So the skin is the boundary between ourselves and the world. And according to the founder of homeopathy, Samuel Hahnemann, the soric miasm is the oldest one. Everybody since time immemorial had some kind of an itch and they would scratch it. And the feeling is that I'm not quite okay in the world. And that's a miasm. It pertains to obviously a lot of skin conditions, but also just a vague feeling that things are not going right. When people have anxiety around money or they feel that they're running in place, or they eat like there's no tomorrow. These are all subcategories of that particular miasm. That is the existential question there. In other words, that could be asked at the subconscious level without one being aware of it. If you're genuinely struggling, you're going to the bank and sweating it out that you're going to get a loan, well, that's not even existential. It's a very pressing, immediate concern. But these remedy states, if you have the condition and the homeopath identifies it and the remedy that pertains to it, you kind of bring it to the level of consciousness. For example, a major soric remedy is Calcarea carbonica, which is made from the shell of the oyster. People who need that remedy they tend to get overwhelmed. They tend to be list makers. They tend to see the big picture and they do ask big questions about life, like what's the point of everything? They're not particularly neurotic, but then when we go and analyze the remedy itself, it gets interesting. So the oyster shell is the house of the oyster, right? It's the roof over the oyster's head. This is a very, very important remedy. So when we're born, each one of us is kind of a naked little oyster. Suddenly we're exposed to the world, and where's our house? What's going to cover us? And the skull, our scalp, is literally the roof of our being. And so if an infant has the fontanelles of the skull not coming together That is literally that metaphor come to life. When will it all come together for me? And that remedy, Calcarea Carbonica, comes into play. If I ask somebody what they're like at their absolute worst, what's their biggest stress, and they say, I just get overwhelmed, I'm just too much going on, that will indicate this remedy. When you need this remedy, and you, again, you're not perfectly okay in the world, that creates a kind of a problem at the metabolic level, because people who need that remedy tend to gain weight very easily. They sweat easily, and they get out of breath when they go upstairs. So it's a whole picture. But at the root is this question: I'm not okay in the world. My safety concerns overrun me. I don't feel sheltered. Not a big psychological issue, except for the fact that it has these implications. That's a major remedy within the soric miasm, and the quandary there is: Am I okay in the world? Can my existence be sustained?
I think I need oyster shells, Jerry. I'm a list maker, constantly making lists, and I do feel I always feel like I'm never on top of everything. There's just so much to do. So
let me put another finer point on that, just to make explain how homeopathic thinking works. We deal very much in polarities. Almost, well, I do at least all the time, which makes it funny to me when there's such a thing as a bipolar disease. To me, every state has polarities. Every chronic condition represents the vital force's inability to have resolved something and reacted to it with an acute illness, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. In a chronic state, you've got good days and bad days. It's always there. But so the calcarea person is analytical, right? So you're analytical. That's your go-to mode. You break things into their parts. That's how I'll get a handle on this. Well, what happens when suddenly you've got too many parts? And then you go into, you're overwhelmed, but your only go-to mode is to break things into their parts again. So you spiral down. That's how that polarity leads to the all the physical complaints and the mental complaints within that remedy state.
Fascinating. So how does... what is the mechanism whereby an existential concern leads to stress, and then the stress leads to illness?
In homeopathy, we don't get mechanistic like that. It's not a reductionist medicine. It's simply that's as deep as I can go. I have a few more things I can say about it, it's not something you'd probably call a mechanism. So the miasms all represent the effect of a disease that's gone through many generations and left traces on the descendants. So when you're born, you're not necessarily, you're not a blank slate. If your ancestors have gone through droughts and starvation and had to scramble for their existence and were highly entrepreneurial, you might be born with that particular miasm being very prominent in you. And so that's likely where you're going to land. And the four other miasms all relate to more recognizable diseases like cancer, tuberculosis, gonorrhea, and syphilis. Sora is something that the ordinary person who's not involved with homeopathy would think of. But so the mechanism would be, at least at the genetic or the epigenetic level, a legacy, something that has happened earlier on that is consolidated within inheritable consciousness and makes the descendants prone to playing that out again. I'm not sure if it's actually genetic or epigenetic or it's spiritual. It kind of doesn't matter to a homeopath, but we have to recognize those things. And when we prescribe with these very dilute substances reflecting the situation, things get very much better. Not just that the symptoms go away, but the issue loses its charge. And that's how the person gets better. What's back to your original question, what's interesting about existential questions is they don't have a clear-cut answer, in terms of arithmetic or yes or no kind of thing. They just have a powerful charge. You would know if you've always been worrying about money, whether no matter how much you have. And by the way, someone can need that remedy and be very affluent. It's not a question over their external circumstances. It's something that's ingrained. What was I saying? So. Yeah, the remedy removes the charge of that question, and then it's in your rearview mirror. And you say, what was that all about? Why was I so concerned about that?
And I know I asked you this the last time we spoke when we were discussing your book, Sane Asylum. And that is how and who made the connection, or how were the connections made let's say, for example, with you know, minute traces of the oyster shell, in order to treat this particular existential stress or illness, this the idea that there is this, you know, metaphorical relationship between the oyster shell, which turns out to be the remedy. I mean, how was that connection made?
Well, that's a great question, Richard. How will you discover homeopathic remedies? Some are done deliberately through homeopathic research. Some are by the way, the research is called the proving, comes from the German word Prüfung. I should just describe how that works. It's homeopathic remedies are all research on healthy individuals, not sick individuals, which is kind of interesting. So we get maybe 6 or 7 people, all healthy, to commit to keeping their lives stable for several months. And then they agree to take a certain substance, which is not identified. So that part of the research is blinded. And on a regular basis, and they keep journals of what goes on in their life. And so at the end of that, those journals are forwarded to the proving organizer. And this big collation task takes place, where we siphon out the peculiar, the strange, unusual symptoms that are consistent through that population. Let's say everybody finds out that they sneeze when they see a piano. I made up that ridiculous example. Well, you may not want to treat that, but it might be a clue to a remedy that can treat something really significant. But if on day 4, someone says, I got a terrible headache, I wrote this down, but come to think of it, a brick fell on my head a couple of minutes before, we don't count that. But these symptoms which are persistent and across the board are the signature of that particular substance. And that's what gets sanctified in the Materia Medica book, one of our basic texts. So that's how the research works. But that's not the whole picture. So then we use that remedy based on that. Homeopath waits till somebody comes in who has the symptoms and behaviors and quirks that came out of the proving. And using that remedy many, many times, the homeopath will also project his or her input into that materia medica, because when we self-report, we can't see ourselves at the same time. So what we see also gets entered into that. Now that's a research proving. It can also happen that information comes about accidentally. Here's a famous story. Constantine Hering in the early 1900s wanted to find a very, very lethal snake, because we always knew that the more horrible the substance, the more powerful the medicine, because we're counting on this paradoxical effect, right? Where you treat what the substance causes. So typically, if you get something really nasty, well, then the homeopathic version of that will treat somebody with that very nasty condition. Anyway, Hering traveled by ship to South America looking for this snake, and it was the Brazilian bushmaster. And he and his wife caught one, and they played around with it. And it's not really clear if it actually bit him or if he just got infected by the venom. But he nearly died. He was on his deathbed, rambling and talking, and all kinds of stuff came out of his mouth and his behaviors. He and his wife was a great, great companion. She wrote everything down, and that was the information we got on that remedy, which is now called Lachesis. That's how we found that out, through that accidental proving. But how else? There's other ways which it can be done as well. But then the question is, how do we pick the substance that we're going to to research? By the way, and also the early remedies were often just conventional drugs that doctors were using that we just decided we had to make remedies from. For example, mercury was being used left and right by the physicians to treat not just syphilis, which it could suppress, but all kinds of other stuff. They used it off indication. So people became mad as hatters, and the condition of erythism arose. And so homeopaths had to clean that mess up, and they would take mercury and make a very, very dilute remedy from it. All the drugs actually became homeopathic remedies too. So they just announced themselves, they selected themselves. But if you know that something is going on in the world, that somehow a substance has come into tremendous prominence, I would suggest plastic or one of the newer drugs like Lipitor. Lipitor, I'm not sure if it's true anymore, but it was the most widely prescribed drug in the world. And I took a personal interest in what its materia medica was, and I organized a small proving that I didn't quite complete on Lipitor. because, again, if it produces a certain picture and you see that someone comes into your office, then you have to give the dilute version of that same substance. So we're constantly detoxifying people, and we pay attention to what's going on in the world. And the research of which can be done, there was a proving done, some, you know, very creative stuff. A large organization wanted, you know, took a sampling from all the oceans in the world and made a remedy from that and distributed it around the world to homeopaths everywhere. And we weren't told what it was. But all of us around the world took that substance, and then we reported our results to the central prover. I didn't know what it was, but the day after I took that remedy, that I took that substance, I had incredibly vivid dreams of flooding everywhere, every place being flooded. So that would go into the materia medica of that remedy once that's established.
Did you find out?
We also make remedies from milks. Milks are incredibly important, right? In the mammal kingdom. Look at this. This is interesting, I think. So we have remedies made from human milk, from the milk of combinations of women, from many of the mammals. When a proving was done of elephant milk, Richard, and this is really a sad thing. Again, people weren't told what they were taking. They just kept journals. Many of them reported having dreams of extinction.
Wow, that's remarkable.
Yeah, so this stuff comes out. So this is why homeopaths know that when they're investigating a substance or using it a lot, or participating in approving, that they're entering into the consciousness of that substance at a very deep level.
Jerry, we're going to take a time out. We'll come back and continue to discuss the emotional roots of chronic illness. Stay with us.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive.
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator.
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinton County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress. Jerry Cantor is with us, and we are exploring the profound connections between emotions and their physical manifestations in illness, particularly existential stress. My wife is Greek, and we talk a lot about, you know, the Greek gods and goddesses and Greek legends, and of course the Greek god Sisyphus, you know, is rolling that boulder up the hill, and it keeps rolling down, and he's become sort of synonymous with existential suffering. Might there have been a cure for Sisyphus, or a treatment?
So he gets my treatment in the book. I talk about two remedies that Sisyphus could have used, and I have, of course, the joke that you'd never get them because what Amazon courier would want to go down that deep into hell to bring it to him. But one of the remedies that I associated with Sisyphus is a remedy called germanium, and people who need that remedy just hate their job. It's so repetitious. They're just going through the motions day in and day out, you know, like Sisyphus did. It's completely ridiculous. And that could be for somebody who's a bureaucrat. And I had a job like this for a while. It was all just make work. Jan Schulten, one of my colleagues, a fantastic Swedish homeopath, equates it with another remedy, osmium, which has to do with the downfall of a great and powerful king. And so, yeah, I go quite into detail on those two particular remedies, why they would help. The problem with Sisyphus, of course, he's immortal. So how long you probably run out of giving him remedy for that period of time. But the issue that's embodied in that story, you know, does have reverberations for homeopathy. Quite interesting. So naming, we want to talk about a number of the elements on the periodic table. In fact, are names for Greek gods and mythical characters, and you'd think that they were named by homeopaths because the associations are so interesting. Here's one story I will give you that I think you'll enjoy concerning an element on the periodic table. It's not named after a Greek god, but it's one of my favorite stories. Marie Curie, who discovered radium. She was a Polish woman, and she was working in Paris when she discovered this other substance. She wasn't really looking for it. She said, "What the heck is this? Some great thing." And at the moment, she knew it was something different. It wasn't radium. It was something completely different. And she named it polonium because at that particular moment, she was so nostalgic for Poland. Right? Okay. So what is polonium used for? This is one of these, we have all these synchronicities that we deal with, and it makes you think, Did her imagination create this, the materia medica of polonium? Was she in tune with it in some way? Because when polonium is used in situations where there's a tremendous amount of nostalgia, it actually comes up for people who are in some situation where they're longing, not just in touch with the past, but really longing for it. It would be the situation of Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard. But here's something. Listen to this. Do you remember the Russian diplomat in England? His name was Litvinenko.
Yeah, he was radiated with. He was poisoned.
Is that the one? What it was? What was used?
I don't.
Spoiler alert: polonium.
Oh.
It was polonium. Now polonium is not an easy thing to get, right? They could have used rat poison. They could have used arsenic. They could have used all kinds of stuff. What was the reason why they gave polonium? I'm convinced, whether consciously or subconsciously, they knew what that substance was existentially, and they said, "Hey, you think the KGB, you think we're dinosaurs, you think we're part of the past. That's what you think, right? Here's a taste of the past, and we'll kill you." And that is what I think of why they gave that particular remedy. And by the way, going back to Norma Desmond, polonium is a very useful metal in the preservation of movies. So all these things come together for that. And naming itself is a very powerful, the lesson here is naming is very, very powerful. And we know that from indigenous myths. We all know the power of a name. When you name something, you create a deep connection with it. with it. I don't know, in Marie Curie's case or many of these other cases, are you actually imputing your consciousness to that substance, or are you so in tune with it that you're reflecting what it's about? So this is the realm of the existential, in my opinion. The meaning, where the meaning of things is so important. And so to a good homeopath, when we treat somebody, you know, if we just had a remedy that just erased your symptoms every day, you know, we didn't have any idea what was going on, we wouldn't bother getting out of bed. It's the fact that when you take someone's case and you treat them, and you get a deep insight into their existential situation in the world, what their stance is, and then the remedy carries that out by removing that stance, it makes life very, very meaningful. And we're meant to learn from our illnesses. I have this adage that acute illness detoxifies us, but chronic illness informs, provided that you can interpret the symptoms. You know, we're not meant to be just sipping pina coladas on the beach most of our rest of our life. We are meant to, we are here to struggle, to suffer, and to evolve, in my opinion. And illness is a great, great teacher. Can be a harsh teacher, but homeopathy illuminates those dark corners in our life so we can actually deal with our illness, but come out of it not just symptom free, but with a much broader sense of perspective.
We mentioned Sisyphus in the Greek god, but in so much of our literature, you know, before he got himself into some big scandal, I'm a huge fan of Woody Allen. I would go to every Woody Allen movie that came out, and Woody Allen is all about, you know, existentialism. He's always asking the big existential questions, and his character is usually suffering existential stress in the movies. Why are we so preoccupied with it?
Well, the thing about death, when I talk about remedy like arsenicum, I would always think about what someone like Woody Allen who'd become not just obsessed with death, but very upset, you know, very OCD-ish about it. Well, I know when he travels, he carries big bags and bags of medicines with him. By the way, everybody has all this stuff. It's just when one of the quandaries raises its profile within us, that's when we have to pay more attention to it. We're all obsessed with everybody's mishigas. Everybody has something going on. This is what also makes homeopathy so interesting. When I sit down and take someone's case, I just wait to see what's making this person tick and not tick. But the death is a big one, and so that pertains to one of my existential questions, which is, can the boundary between life and death be abided? So the boundary is there. The boundary is there, right? How do people handle it? Some people want to be our escapists. They want to deny it completely, so they would live on the materialist side of it, the instant gratification side of it. I want glamour, money, sex. That's all there is. I don't want to deal with death. I'm just going to get it all right here, right? On the other side of that divide would be people who say, absolutely, I know I'm going to die. That's not important. What matters is that I leave something for my descendants, that I leave something for them, that I create a legacy. Now, that can be a problem, too. I can tell you remedies that are on both sides of that divide.
What is the problem with wanting to leave a legacy for your descendants? How do you get into trouble?
Yeah, okay. What is the problem there? Well, it's in Chinese medicine, we'd probably say that it stresses the kidneys. This is you'd have to look at the remedies. Well, I'll give you an example of somebody who would be in that state, and then I'll talk about the remedy the problems that it causes. Winston Churchill, in my opinion, would be an avatar for the remedy made from silver, argentum metallicum. That's the remedy that is primarily about one leaving one's legacy. If you asked Winston Churchill what his greatest failure was, what his greatest stress was, it was that he lost, that the Great Britain lost India on his watch. Now, India was the crown jewel of the British Empire. Mm-hmm. Now, here's again with the area where metaphor and language is very, very interesting. When men talk about their testicles, they call them the crown jewels. they're cojones, it's the crown jewels. And this remedy and all the remedies that are usually often metals have this affinity for the male for the reproductive system. other things about the remedy, silver nitrate, which absolutely perfectly fit Winston Churchill. And language is so supportive of these understandings. He was what the greatest orator that we've ever had in modern times. So when people need silver nitrate, I mean, silver, argentum, silver, they often have trouble with their voice, but from overuse, or they become exhausted. And then there's the expression, being born with a silver spoon in your mouth. That metaphor also is about your legacy, you know, your parents' legacy, which you represented in you. You know, the language is so amazing, so rich in terms of what it conveys.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, that's a prime remedy for people who have voice problems, who are very interested in creativity, silver. Oh, by the way, the expression, a silver-tongued orator.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that an accident? Again, language is so incredible. That's all embodied. We all know this on some level. And we persuaded ourselves that we must be making things up. Metaphors can't be literal. But it's actually there. But yeah, it's a remedy that Churchill, by the way, was very creative. He was also an artist.
Yes, he was. A painter.
But yeah, there definitely are problems on that side. He was quite obsessed with legacy, but it caused him heart, you know, whatever. I did not take his case, so I can't tell you. But I can almost promise you that if he was my patient, he would have gotten that remedy for almost whatever ailment he had.
The Emotional Roots of Chronic Illness, Homeopathy for Existential Stress. Jerry Cantor stays with us, back with more of Strange Planet right after this timeout.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I'm a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
The truth will set you free. Free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Existential psychology. I mean, so much of what we're talking about almost sounds as if it is the source of the illness is in the mind. Is that what we're really talking about, existential psychology here?
Well, the problem I have with psychology is that it does not take into account, legacy-driven quandaries. You know, it's basically about here and now. That's why I think, and all due modesty, this book is a reinvention of existential psychology, which deals basically with one's, you know, behavior in this life. It doesn't take into account what we call legacies, problems that we have inherited. And also, the problem with psychology is that academically, psychologists are not actually it's right in their regulations. They're not allowed to deal with physical problems, which is so strange, because we the mind and the body are completely fused. It's not like just an accidental connection. This is a problem in Western science, Western medicine. But I'll talk about one, an existential quandary that is more more readily, you know, understandable psychologically. Okay, and I'll give you the miasm that it's part of and the quandary that it represents. It's another really super important remedy. Is Lycopodium clavatum. Lycopodium is made from a moss, which is about 3 inches high. People who need that remedy, this is a subcategory of the second existential question, well, which I just kind of gave before, which is my existence on Earth sustainable? And that quandary has an affinity for the teenage years. Hmm. And it's very much a metabolic remedy. And in Chinese medicine, this is the element of earth. Well, anyway, someone who needs lycopodium is insecure, and what you find with someone like this is that interactions feel like there's a winner and a loser. It's often a great remedy for appetite disorders, for people who can't stand to be confronted. They can't stand confrontations. They're likely to have big difficulty with public speaking. They ping pong between being overly compliant, being a people pleaser, and being a control freak. They go back and forth. That miasm says, they're not okay in the world. There's something that's not okay in the world for them. So now, early on in life, this is very understandably psychological. There are three big jumps we have to make from A to B that involve the exchange of a state of dependency for a state of independence and a gain of a core competency. Being weaned from the breast, being toilet trained, and learning how to read. You can see how that's a trade. Going from A to B involves state of dependency being changed for a state of independence. If any of those things don't go well, the person is really insecure. They feel they compare themselves with other people, they can't focus, and they tend to fall into this lycopodium state. And it's a hugely important developmental remedy, because I've never met anyone who is not small and towered over by their older siblings and by their parents. And they say, the psyche says, oh, you're so much bigger than me. You're so much smarter. You're so much everything. I'll never catch up to you. And they kind of stuck there. And this state, which involves feeling like every interaction has a winner and a loser, is established. Now, the lycopodens, actually, which I said is 3 inches tall, in primeval times was a forest. It was actually very tall. If you can imagine a moss the size like 30 feet high or something. But then the gymnosperm trees came along, which were, in fact, much bigger, much stronger, much sturdier, and towered over the lycopodens forest. So its evolutionary strategy was to shrink itself down to 3 inches. And that is totally embodied by that fantastic remedy, which I have to give, you know, so much of the time. Almost everybody at some point needs that remedy. And the symptoms of that would be they eat beyond their hunger. They're highly distractible. They have various kinds of skin conditions. They'll be controlling about one thing and be people pleasers on another level. So you'll find a lot of people who go into martial arts need this remedy, or politicians who want to be loved so badly. You know, Clinton and Nixon all had this very, very prominently. The problem is you always feel like you're biting off more than you can chew. Eating is a political act within that remedy, because you eat beyond your hunger. Or you'll be drawn to foods that you can crunch, like crunchy foods. All these crazy things are connected within the meaning of that remedy. And the deep feeling is of that of insecurity. You cannot genuinely you cannot in a natural way access your power, so that you don't feel like interactions, you know, is a winner or loser. Like if I'm talking to you and I'm in that state, I might be really worried that you're liking me, and am I talking too much? In marriages, people like that will marry someone much older than them, typically. Or if they're girls, they'll get their period either too early or too late. Everything tends to be a little political. And the remedy will mature a person like that, so that they actually come through a developmental phase. And that's existential.
It's fascinating. This is absolutely fascinating. There seems to be this real connection between traditional Chinese medicine and homeopathy and existential stress. Why is that?
Well, in my own work, I was an acupuncturist for a long time. I mean, I still am. I still work under my acupuncture license. Chinese medicine has the mind-body connection hardwired there. It's just not terribly sophisticated. If you see an acupuncturist and you have you report that your stools are loose, the acupuncturist will automatically assume that this is an earth problem and that you worry too much, you're anxious. Conversely, if you worry too much, and you go there and you tell the acupuncturist, "Oh, I'm just a worry wart," the acupuncturist might assume that you have loose stools. It's just hardwired. Grief. I mean, so the five elements or five phases. They associated with the five major systems of the body, the five seasons. Well, that's a kind of a fudge there. The five sense organs, and I really work on all these connections. What Chinese medicine has given me was this kind of a cosmology that enabled me to apply that to homeopathy. So we have five miasms in classical homeopathy, and so I made the connection between those five miasms and this pre-established cosmology in Chinese medicine, you know, which connects an organ with an emotion. You can go through it. You know, the heart and the sense of touch are closely connected within the tubercular miasm, I should say, in homeopathy, which is about isolation versus synchrony. Anyway, it became a template for me, and I was really obsessed with working all the connections out, and that's what I've been doing for a few years.
Just explain again what miasms are.
Yeah, miasms are the inherited disposition to a condition, you know, based on a disease that has rampaged through the population earlier on. I think Ibsen's novel Ghosts, which says the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children. That kind of idea. So the five miasms are sora, which I talked about before, tuberculosis, gonorrhea, syphilis, and cancer. So where there's a real strong history of that in one particular lineage, you will find characteristics, both good and bad, which are passed on to the descendants. Doesn't mean that you actually are going to get that disease. It does not mean that. But there are qualities and susceptibilities that pertain to each of those pictures. We all have all of those things, by the way. But when one of them is prominent in one of us, you know, then it would receive homeopathic attention.
What is, and I'm asking for one that you haven't mentioned already, of course, and that is, what is the most existential homeopathic remedy you can think of?
Oh, yeah. Well, they all are, but I'll give you the one that's my, well, there's two, there's one which is my favorite. And I could talk about that for hours. And that is thuja, thuja. And that pertains to the water miasm. I'm sorry, to the air element in Chinese medicine, and the question of orientation. Where am I in time and space? People who need thuja and have very inauthentic lives. They simply cannot access their self-interest. Their self-esteem is so poor. They cannot access. They just cannot do something which is genuinely in their own interest because they suffered so terribly from what's the expression? Imposter syndrome. That's one expression of it. All of France was in this state after World War II, which is where they came up. They the whole term of all this lingo about inauthenticity and. You know, that was derived in France because the poor French had their self as a society had their self-esteem trampled on. This is a society of people who love to argue and love sensuous meals and playful language and philosophy. And then they got occupied by these rigid goose-stepping Germans and their identity was just destroyed. Next thing you know, they're talking existentialism. Oh, nothing has had any meaning anymore. You cannot read a novel. We don't know what it means, you know. And Sartre, I don't know if you've tried to read Sartre's book, 500-page book on being and nothingness. In my opinion, it's unreadable. It's absolutely unreadable. Yeah, and he's just nihilism. Perseverating on this idea, trying to define non-meaning in non-meaning terms. I mean, I was a philosophy student, and I give myself leeway to say these things. But back to the thuja people. So yeah, if you've been treated early on in your life, if you've been belittled, or you haven't learned at some early lesson, some early time, that love is conditional, that who you actually are is not as important as what you do. come home. If you don't give me, bring home a good grade, you know, nothing to me, you know? Unfortunately, there's quite a bit of this. So the lesson gets ingrained that I cannot be who I actually am. You know, Richard, another way of talking about this is to refer to the great Groucho Marx joke that he would not join a club that would have him as a member, yeah. Right? I mean, so self-deprecation is a real big part of this. Their inner core is so ugly, so full of shame that they'll project some kind of other persona. They're fantastic chameleons. Doesn't mean they won't succeed in the world, but they can make endless fun of themselves. They're taking, you know, taking something horrible about themselves and making it acceptable. Many comedians have this quality. But at the level of pathology, they will have warts. They will have all kinds of horrible skin conditions. They'll feel like something is moving in the intestines. But the most remarkable thing is at the mental emotional level that they'll make decisions which are so clearly not in their self-interest, because they'd rather be anybody other than who they genuinely are. And when you peel that layer away, then they become more authentic. But you may then reveal a level of depression, of sadness, which is authentic and then has to be dealt with. I want to give you an example of it because you asked one of my favorite questions. So a family brought me their teenage boy into my office one day and said, "What can you do for this kid? This is just horrible." I said, "What's the matter?" "He thinks he's a robot." I said, "What?" "Yeah, so I talked to him, what's going on here?" "Yeah, I'm a robot. I'm absolutely a robot." And he defeated several therapists who said, "You're not a robot. Can't you see that you have freedom of movement that you can think, I'm a robot. Live with it." So what I did with I said, "Look, not a problem. I've treated many robots before. This is fine. No problem whatsoever." So I took his case, and here's what happened. He was sitting in biology class, and they were teaching Darwinism. Now, there are a lot of other kids in the class who didn't have this takeaway that he had. But he listened to this thing about birds having no control over what color their feathers were, which were completely influenced by the external environment. And he said, "That's me. I have no control of what's happened to me. And then I must be a robot." Now, it didn't happen out of the blue. If you go digging further into his life, the groundwork for that was created in his family, whereby he was already treated in some kind of disparaging fashion, that he was belittled, and he already didn't think that he was very worthwhile. But he took it. This is input was not a stupid thing to do. It was just not in his self-interest to do that, to go around life acting like a robot. He actually felt that way. So I gave him that remedy, and just as I expected, when he came back the next time, he was no longer a robot, but he was deeply depressed. Right. So the remedy, the Thuja state, was insulating him from the authentic pain of having been neglected in his life. In the Thuja state, the pain was so severe that there's kind of a layer of inauthenticity sheltered him from the actual pain of that. So homeopaths peel the onion. We peeled that away. And when he came back, I had to give him a different remedy. In that case, it was natrum sulfurica. And both of these remedies, Thuja and natrum sulfurica, fall into the miasmatic category of psychosis, spelled S-Y-C-O-S-I-S, which represents a past history and the legacy of gonorrhea. I mean, it's a lot to absorb what I'm saying right now. But if you're homeopathy land, this is everyday stuff. And in that psychosis, the problem with the psychological issues there is that you do not have a real handle on your identity. Like Thuja, clearly very poor sense of his identity, so fragile that he could become anything. They become chameleons. They will fit in anywhere. Become something that is not them, because their actual sense of self-worth is inaccessible.
Oh, absolutely fascinating. It almost about out of time here, but I'm also sensing, I don't know, some connections with Jungian psychology here. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it is. And in my final existential question, which is actually, that's actually not the final one. It is the same one about the boundary between life and death be abided, which is all about the consolidation. It's the existential issue there is consolidation versus entropy. That's the actual existential issue. So entropy is everything falling apart, death being, oh my God, we're just flying apart, there's nothing there. And the flip side of that is consolidation, which is something that you've learned, that you gained in this lifetime, is consolidated within your legacy, and in my opinion, projected out into the what Jung called as universal subconscious. So I'm on the same page with Jung about that. I do think that. So, and as a matter of fact, what a remedy is, if this is as far as I can go in talking about what the mechanism is, when a remedy is needed and there's all these diverse, crazy symptoms in somebody, the psyche, in my opinion, goes up to that Jungian universe and finds an archetype that connects all the dots, that within all which all those things are united. And that is the mindset or the subconsciousness of a particular substance or plant, you know, which, and I've talked about silver up to this point, and, you know, like a podium. These are not just substances, but they have another spiritual being at the other in the spirit world, in terms of you know, the essence of you know, of what its consciousness represents, and all the implications of that. And yeah, I do resonate with Jung about that. There is a collective unconscious, and which is full of these archetypes that our psyche goes very hungrily goes and pulls down into our cell, into our psyche, to express what's going on with us.
The emotional roots of chronic illness, homeopathy for existential stress. Jerry, always a pleasure. Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Richard, you're an excellent interviewer, and thank you for letting me go on and on about it. But I'm kind of inspired about it, and I love talking about it. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.